Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Build.
Film.
Conversation. Hooray!
We're so happy about that, Anthony. Yay!
He's making up for his husky voice that he's trying to hide, I reckon. Anyway, I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. With me to have a conversation about a film is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
And Abigail Bain.
Hi there.
So, we are a podcast collective, if you will, and we talk about films. This is Spoiler Filled Film Conversation. Hooray, as we have already said. And we just talk about a film every time. This week's film is That Championship Season. Fucking weird title, I know. But I didn't pick it. It was Jamie. Jamie, explain what That Championship Season is.
Okay. That Championship Season is a film from 1982, directed by Jason Miller, written by Jason Miller, adapted from his play from about 10 years earlier. And it's about four high school friends who are on a championship basketball team. They meet up with their coach, and then things start to unravel. They spend the night together meeting up and reminiscing, and
well, that's the key thing, is they're older and they're meeting up, they're not still in high school.
Yeah. But also there's like a political aspect to it, because Bruce Dern's character, I should go through the cast, it stars Bruce Dern, Stacey Keach, Robert Mitchum, Martin Sheen, Paul Savino. That's the main cast. And a lot of it is, oh, it's that guy. It's particularly Bruce Dern and Paul Savino.
Ah, oh, it's that guy from Silent Running.
Oh. Yeah.
That was my one.
And Stacey Keach. And I'm guessing everybody knows why I picked this one.
It probably, like every film you pick, connects to the Exorcist. Yes. In some way.
Jason Miller is the actor who plays Father Karras in The Exorcist.
And what's the deal, Jamie? Seriously, you're addicted to The Exorcist and everything. Yes. Connecting to it.
Well, I've wanted to see this for ages because I knew, from my insatiable desire to know every little thing about The Exorcist and how it was made, I knew that Jason Miller was cast as Father Karras, having not been an actor, really. He was a playwright. And he'd already written That Championship Season. It had been on stage before he was cast as Father Karras. If I remember right, William Friedkin cast him just because of his, intensity. And he didn't really do a lot of acting after that. He was Father Karras. He was in the same character-ish in Exorcist 3. And he was in The Ninth Configuration, which we did, which also starred Stacey Keach. But this was the only film he ever directed. And after watching it, I can see why.
Yeah. I mean, there's reasons, I suppose.
I didn't realise there was actually a remake of this in the late 90s.
Yeah, I found that out.
Because I accidentally rented it on Amazon and started watching it. I just wasted $3 on this.
Or did you? Maybe it's brilliant. Yeah, we're talking about the original one. Didn't watch that, so...
I was going to say, I'm hoping we watched the 1982 one, because that's the one I watched.
Yeah. If not, I just keep it a secret and pretend like you know what you're talking about.
But, I was interested to see it just because I know that the original play got a lot of praise. Hmm. And again, even though, despite what I said about him as a director, I can see why the play would have got a lot of critical acclaim. But unfortunately, I'll get into it later, but I was going to say, it doesn't seem like it translates very well to the screen.
Well, you were curious about it. That's the reason you wanted to check it out.
And I wanted to see, I was interested in what Jason Miller would be like as a director, because William Peter Blatty, who wrote the book of The Exorcist, has only ever directed two films. One of those was Ninth Configuration and then Exorcist 3, and both of them had Jason Miller in. And he had they're both very much writers, Jason Miller and William Peter Blatty. And I thought it would be interesting to look at whether or not they had similar directorial styles, because William Peter Blatty's very not slapstick, but very exaggerated, and kind of you can see he's from like a comedy background. Even in something like Exorcist 3, he uses a lot of over the top techniques. Whereas
some epic lols.
Oh yeah, well you know what I mean. Like the Ninth Configuration was a very strange film.
Sure.
And a lot of it was very like comedy orientated, even if it wasn't a comedy. Whereas this, that Championship Season, is very much almost completely dialogue driven, but that ends up being a problem. Get into that. I'll let someone else talk.
Yeah. What about you, Anthony? What were you expecting when this came up for us to watch?
Well, because it's a slightly obscure film, I suppose we'd say.
Difficult to track down, to be honest.
Yeah, and that's kind of the first thing that shaped my opinion, was we had trouble just finding it anywhere. So, like, this is a mystery film that both never hear of. It could be the most wonderful, like, cult classic you've ever seen.
No.
Or it might be, like, utter dreck. So I really didn't know what to expect from this one. Although, I will go on that, Jamie's picks relating to The Exorcist have been usually pretty good, other than The Exorcist 2, but we won't mention that.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've just kind of I thought it might be a pretty engaging, interesting film, probably a lot of drama, but I really didn't know where it was going to go.
Yeah. When I looked it up, it was like, okay, so a bunch of men in shirts looking like they slightly get into a conversation that leads to an argument or something. That's, you know, I think I saw the trailer and it was like, oh, some men shifting around. I was getting that kind of 12 Angry Men vibe about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm kind of glad we ended up doing this so soon after 12 Angry Men, because they're kind of similar in terms of them being men in a room and it all coming from the dialogue, but...
It could go on a box set, couldn't it? Like 12 Angry Men and that Championship Season. I don't know what you'd call it. The Sweaty Angry Conversations box set or whatever. But I wasn't sure. Championships, unless they're in wrestling, I'm not that interested. So I wasn't sure if I would be interested in any sports link. It's there as a metaphor and a reason to have these characters know each other, really. But we'll talk about the implications of the championship. It's a weird bloody title. I don't know. To say that championship season is a bit weird is what I mean, you know?
Yeah, it's referring to their winning season when they were undefeated.
Yeah, but I also don't really understand how you can win a season and not just the cup.
I don't know. anything about sport. Let's not pretend that we do.
That's it. I had no reason to be like, oh, I can't wait to think and talk about sport or whatever. But it's mainly about middle-aged men dealing with their problems in their life, really. Abby, what were you geared up for before we watched it?
Pretty much just angry men getting het up.
Which I think is pretty much the blurb, right? Angry men getting het up. Or like juvenile, slightly misogynistic... men getting drunk and het up might be how I'd phrase it, but I think you're right, Abby. It's not... You weren't wrong with your expectations if that's all you thought. Were you expecting to like it, or...?
I don't know if it... Like, Jamie's happy that we did it like close to 12 Angry Men because they're similar, but for me, it's a bit more, well, I've done this once.
Yeah. I was going to say as well, I'm glad that we did, because this... I sound like I'm being too harsh on it. I have got some praise saved up, but this is an example of the 12 Angry Men setup done not wrong necessarily, but without the focus.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. Sorry, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, that's weird.
Do you want to say it then, Anthony? Let's talk about the film in some detail. The opening I thought was interesting. For two reasons. One, it involves cheerleaders who are all fairly young women bending over to reveal their knickers in some kind of outside political gathering, and they all throw their skirts up and bend over and show their bums, And they all have the letters of the mayor of the town on their arse, including an exclamation mark on the last girl, which I thought was particularly in bad taste, to highlight her little butthole with an exclamation point. So, you know, reactions to that shit.
The opening, the whole opening section, apparently, I didn't know this, was the whole thing about the elephant was done for the film. That wasn't in the play. It was in the play, but it was mentioned, but it doesn't happen. And this
I was going to say, a little later on, they kind of mention something that happens to the elephant in passing, and it's like, oh, what? When did that happen? So, well, I think that kind of fiddled with that moment there as well.
It was interesting when I actually found that reading about the film after watching it, because the major problem I had with this film was the endless setup before they actually get to meeting up with each other.
I guess, but it's kind of refreshing. If anything, you needed a break at the end of the film to be outside to walk around the city a bit, because you'd been getting warm and passively drunk with these men for a while at the end.
Well,
you know.
See, that was the problem I had, is that the part of the film I cared about was the whole part in the house. Yeah. And I didn't feel like any of the setup was necessary, and it was so, like, it set up so many story threads that ended up being resolved just in dialogue in the house for the last hour and 20 minutes or whatever it was. No, it was less than that. It's like 1 hour is just set up, and then another hour is the actual meat of the story.
Yeah. It's interesting that I bring up cheerleaders' bums and how inappropriate they felt, and you guys directly talk about the elephant in the room, which was a literal elephant in this case, or an elephant in the open, I guess.
But I mean, it was kind of funny that the elephant just immediately died. And
we should say that the part of the start of the film is like they're having this in the park political campaign rally. Thing, show.
Bruce Dern's character is the mayor.
Yeah.
Stacey Keach and Paul Sorvino are his, like, Stacey Keach works, he's the head teacher at a school, at a high school.
And is assisting the mayor in some way.
Yeah, and Paul Sorvino is a businessman. And they're all, like, in the political scene together. And they're all, like, they're all kind of crooked and pay each other off and let each other get away with stuff. And then you've got Martin Sheen's character, who was one of their friends in high school, and he just left. He disappeared. And I guess the idea is that he was some kind of, like, aspiring writer, and he's just gone off to become an alcoholic. And then you've got the coach, played by Robert Mitchum, who's old. He's sick, but they're all kind of in denial about it. Like, he's recently had an operation, and he's been stitched up, but he's obviously ill in some other way. They're all generally in kind of denial. Like there's an election coming up. Bruce Dern's character is clearly going to probably lose it.
And you know his approach to try and win an election is to gift whatever small city they're from an elephant. Here's an elephant, the symbol of our party, I guess. Everyone loves elephants. Don't think about what I said. Don't think about what I do.
Yeah.
Just love and the elephant and love me because of that.
I will say there's as much as I didn't in the end like the setup that much, I did like the when Martin Sheen arrives back in the town, which is Scranton, I think, which is where Jason Miller's from. Like, I know.
Isn't that exactly where like the American Office is set or something? Like, aren't they from Scranton? It's like a comedy city.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But it's where Jason Miller's from. And if I remember right, there's actually like statue there of him after he died in like 2004. But anyway, I liked it when Martin Sheen's character came back and was walking around and could see everything, like the disrepair and dilapidation everywhere. And it doesn't tell you outright, but you can see that, like, Bruce Dern's character isn't a great mayor, and he's kind of running the place into the ground.
And then it's not that amazing a city either. It's not like a, you know, it's not a big you know, massively important city. No offense, guys who live there. Like, but the film is portraying it like a sort of average Joe meh city, and this guy's a mayor. But it, you know how it's all it sort of lowers the status of everyone because at the end of the day, they're all running for. They're all being a politically part. They're trying to create a political party for a place that's a bit run down and worn out anyway.
And that's the thing, they are as well. Like, they're all getting on, they're all kind of corrupt, but don't really acknowledge it. And then you've got this young guy running against them, who's obviously got a better chance, but they're all still, and you, when they finally meet up with each other and the coach, you realise they're all still kind of riding on the high of this basketball championship they won in high school, whatever it's supposed to be, 27 years ago or something. Like, and the play, you know, the actual dialogue and the main point of the story is this idea of people who don't move on from, you know, the glory days of when people who peaked in high school, and it's Bruce Dern, I think, at one point there's a scene where they go back to the gym in the old school, and he says that he's more proud of that than he is about being mayor.
Yeah, you are doing now, Jamie, what you wish the film to do, which is cut in straight to the meat and potatoes. Yeah. Whereas I think there's elephants and cheerleaders to talk about, and I think that is a good, interesting point to talk about. But we will get there as the film takes its time to show us them.
It takes so long.
It has to show us. Look, here's the town. Here's an elephant. The elephant's dead. Everyone's going to crack jokes, and now we're tipping the elephant in a ditch, and we're getting in trouble because it's actually quite a weird thing to get in trouble for, because you can't help an elephant dying. It's nothing to do with your political campaign. It's just technically linked to you now as a symbol.
It's just a way that they try and cover it up, you know.
So, Abby, is one of the first things that give you a sense of this, whether you're going to like this, the fact that they basically kill an elephant for the plot of the film, did that set you off?
Except you don't kill it for the plot.
Go on.
There's no reason for that elephant to even exist.
Could have come up with a different scandal, you mean?
It wasn't even a scandal, though, was it?
A potential.
Yeah, it's just unnecessary.
Unnecessary elephant.
You saw the elephant, then everyone said it was dead. They said they were going to drop it down a mine shaft. Didn't show you, and then carried on.
Well, they showed them trying to get rid of it in, like, did some kind of... Yeah, they had a whole bit where... they tried to dispose of it, and the press got there and they dropped it and stuff.
But no, that wasn't anywhere near a mineshaft. And when they dropped it, it was clearly rocks in a bit of fire.
Oh, I see, right. I mean, what, you're complaining you didn't get to see an elephant dropped on its face?
I think it's more either do it or don't do it.
Also, you want to see, you kill an elephant? I want to see the dead elephant. Yeah,
where's the corpse?
It's not that much. If you're going to make it a plot point, do something with it.
Stick with it.
I don't know if I'm on board with seeing a dead elephant. It's not the Lion King or anything.
You know what
or
I mean?
Dumbo.
It confused me when they said we'll drop it down a mineshaft. Then you had the other bit where they were doing some other slapstick construction, and the press showed up, and it's like, are you dropping the elephant now? You're in a different place. You've dropped that. You missed. Lol, I guess. What's going on?
In classic spoiler-filled style, the tone was completely off for the first half of the film compared to the second.
I don't know. I'm not ready to suggest that yet. I think the whole first part was to give us context, and maybe it went a bit too far contextualizing the tone, when mainly it was about these desperate middle-aged men pining for their youth and trying to pretend they're not all failures to some extent. And, like, if anything, the idea of themselves in their head isn't the same as the reality, and it's trying to show us that at the beginning. But we don't know what they're like as people yet, so we're just getting loads of, what is this dull politics stuff, and, oh, look, lots of men happy to meet each other. That's bloody interesting, isn't it? Like, lots of back-patting and passing of beers, and, hey, buddy, how's it going? Oh, let's do some jokes in the kitchen, and I'll explain some boring stuff that we don't know anything about.
I know. It was such a, like, I get it. They're friends. I know they are. but you can almost see, because, I've never seen the play, but you can almost kind of guess where the play actually starts.
Mm.
Yeah,
and, like, and to me, it's like it's probably around when they, Martin Sheen and Bruce Dern's characters in his house getting the chicken ready, starting to talk about like why they're there. You can see them like entering the stage together, and then the other characters arrive, and the coach comes down, and all that stuff. You know,
yeah,
that's
because they talk enough about their lives. That, you to be keyed in as
exactly.
To who they are. Yeah.
So there's all of this shit before, and then, and it does it. It gets to that point where they're both at the house, and I just think, what did I just watch that 45 minutes for?
Well, some of it, fair enough. I think you know some bits are just to. Are visually interesting and do something, but then some bits are like, oh, like the business guy, the slightly Italian looking dude. I can't remember names. It's just like
I only know the actor's names. Yeah.
So like mafia guy from all the mafia films is going to pick up Martin Sheen, and you're like, oh, we'll watch him go pick him up, shall we? What the hell are we doing, film? I don't need to see people like get a lift somewhere and like say hello.
It's a bit too handsy with Martin Sheen.
They're all very handsy, aren't they?
No, there was like, there were so many scenes of like people just going, all right,
how's pal, it going? pals together.
Remember. This thing, oh no, save that conversation for later.
Oh, you trickster, you, and oh, I just remember those old days when we were grud and stuff.
Yeah, it's like...
It came across really fake at times as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't understand why any of those people were friends.
Well, that's partly what the film
That's the thing, all of that stuff comes up in the actual story, which is the second half of the film, and... It's like nobody told Jason Miller when he was making it, hey, you don't have to do any of this stuff. Like, this is good. Just keep it in the house.
No, I like driving to a mayor's office where they have a chat about what to do about an elephant dying.
That's it. There was that really nice bit where they took that walk around the garden.
Oh, you say nice bit. I was going to bring this up, funnily enough, as an example of how fake pally they were.
I mean, like, in terms of the visual element of it.
Well,
it's
I think
nice.
Do you mean with all of them and the coach?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure just based on the style of the dialogue and the setup of the scene, that's probably part of the play.
Because they walk around everyone in the audience then instead of the book.
Yeah. Well, it's at that point that the film starts to get a lot more wordy than that. That's the other thing as well. The whole bit with the elephant and the whole introduction isn't like the dialogue isn't as good as the second part.
Maybe, yeah.
The actual second part in the house, the dialogue is way better, which is another reason why you can tell where like the film ends and the play begins. And it frustrated the shit out of me.
Yeah. So, Abby, you thought that the bit where they take a talk... Right, okay, so basically all of this stuff happens at the start to introduce us to the characters, but we've got the mayor of the town. He is friends. He's got political colleagues who work with him, and it's a businessman who financially backs the party a lot, and his assistant who is also a head teacher, and Martin Sheen, who's come back from out of town for a few years, who is a writer of some kind. And they've all met up, and Martin Sheen's character is a surprise return that the coach, who is the actual coach of their high school basketball team, they all meet up. They're meeting up for a reunion. Martin Sheen hasn't been there for a few years, and it's a friendly get together reunion, isn't it?
We should clarify as well that Stacey Keach and Martin Sheen's character are brothers.
Oh, right. I didn't even know that.
What? It's mentioned several times.
Yeah, they said that. You weren't paying attention.
It didn't matter, though, did it? You know,
it did, because Stacey Keach talks about how he stayed behind to look after their dad as he died, where Martin Sheen just fucked off and...
Oh, well, they said brother, and I thought it meant in, like, a, you know...
No, they're literally... Their names are Daly.
They're so pally. When they occasionally mention the word brother, I took it to mean, like, you know, your brothers in arms on the basketball courts.
No,
they also don't look similar.
Well, that's... Yeah.
they talk about it, though. They talk about growing, like, their family.
Yeah, all right. I'll be honest with you.
I think you're going to have to confess here that part 15 was missing on YouTube and you didn't watch it.
I will admit, there is a small 4 to 5 minute part on YouTube with which this was divided up on YouTube that I watched.
Well,
I missed about 4 minutes where some of that might have been clear.
Well, no, because we probably watched the same version, and that the same little chunk was missing, but I paid attention, so
you're right, Dickhead. I made a mistake. I wanted to try and cover it up with Abby's needless honesty, but no, you just criticised me. It was like I don't pay attention to the details. It's about the emotional journey, and I take the ride with everyone. I don't have to care about their names. I told you, it's the Italian bloke who's in loads of mafia movies. It's the bloke who goes up a river in Apocalypse Now. It's the bloke from Silent Running who blows up at the end. Spoilers for that film. And some other random guy who looked like he could have been a principal in any movie.
Stacey Keach.
I don't care. I don't care. I don't care what the character's names were.
That's the actor.
I don't know. I know it's the actor. I know that was the actor's name. I was just saying, I don't care who the characters are. I don't care who the actors are.
Why are you fucking doing this, Rich?
Fuck you guys! I just want to talk about the fucking film. I didn't care that they were brothers. Who gives a shit? They were boring. They were boring people. God's sake.
Oh, this is great because what happened in the film is actually happening in the podcast.
Yay!
Well, I'm not going to be walking around the block hearing you play a record of a different spoiler filled. I'm going to come back in and fucking make friends with you guys.
Which one of us is going to get drunk?
Well, I'm not burning the chicken. I'm going to get that out of the oven right now.
It turns out that Rich is having an affair with Anthony.
Right. Can we get back on track and stop making this personally about us? We don't have a coach for Spoilerfield. We have to get, like, one of our original members back in or something. Right. The point is, these cunts are meeting up as a reunion, right? There's some middle-aged men are meeting up for a reunion of their childhood days.
Yeah.
You've pretty much pinpointed the problem for me. It's just about middle-aged white men problem.
Yeah, you're right. It is just... but it does also reveal how pathetic they all are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's my issue with this, is that when it actually gets going, it's decent, but it takes so fucking long to get there that then I have to, like... It started to pick up, but when it slowed down again within the natural flow of the actual story, I got really bored because I was already bored by the first 45 minutes of the film,
right,
where it's just people driving around and looking at shit. And like,
sure. Well, for me, the first time it started to lose me, because I was just following it for the, you know, to get the gist of it. I wasn't annoyed or anything by this, but I wasn't like dying for the middle bit because I wasn't sure what was to come. So for me, the scene where the coach for some reason comes down the stairs in the house they're all waiting for him in, I don't know how he came in and went upstairs and came down. I didn't understand.
It's his house, and they're just all rolling through it like it ain't no thing.
Yeah, because it's like the mayor walks in like it's his house and they're all knocking around and making stuff while the man that they're there to meet up with is upstairs ignoring them.
Ah. Weren't you paying attention? Bruce Dern
is
having an affair with the coach. No, I didn't quite understand that either. I didn't know, I wasn't sure whose house it was.
He just descends like he's the Messiah and they all rally around him like innocent disciples.
Well, I think that's one of the issues with Jason Miller's style as a director, is that's a little bit... The actual act of him coming down the stairs and sort of appearing is a little bit too symbolic for how dry his direction is.
Mm.
So because it's not very like filmic in any way, it just seems a bit weird. Like, why was he in your house? Because there's no, like, on stage. It's odd.
And they've like brought presents for him. They bought him a small TV, which they put on, which I now find out is his TV. They put a smaller TV as a gift, and they're sort of putting Martin Sheen in the kitchen as a surprise. And it's all a bit, okay, and they're sort of establishing their old schoolboy friends and stuff from, they've like got a history together. Yeah. And this, I don't know if you guys felt the same, I felt as soon as the coach turned up, it was very obviously trying to say they're all back in schoolboy mode. We've seen them as adults working, and now they're like children with their coach. And the fact that they call him coach is kind of creepy.
Oh, that's very American. But no, that is the thing, though. The reason that doesn't work is because it comes after all of this other shit, which is just a different film. Like, yeah, but all this, it's just pointless.
I guess, but this is when they take a walk around the block that Abby said she thought was interesting. Is that right?
Interesting looking.
Interesting. So it's a nice thing to do. I thought it looked really weird because he guided them like Jesus to their old school that's shut down as a surprise. And he's sorry, go on.
They couldn't tell until it was right on top. They were like, "Oh, you're taking us to the school."
Yeah,
but they're all sort of, "Oh, coach, please let me say stuff to you and tease me about the old days." And he's like saying stuff like, "Oh, I'll tell you stuff a coach would say." And it's like, how they're all like hanging off his every word.
Yeah, because
it's like so creepy.
The reason it's weird is that that's the start of the play. That's the introduction to the characters.
I don't think that's it. I think it feels like he's a successful paedophile who has groomed four young boys, and they still love him as adults. And now we're seeing a paedophile with his harem. Well, it's weird.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? Is that later on in the story, when it all starts to fall apart, even there's no suggestion that he's a paedophile. But
no.
The idea of him like having groomed them is an important part of the story because...
Yeah, in a non-sexual way, he has kind of groomed them into men.
He's brainwashed them into this whole, like, oh, yeah, you're champions and you've got to do, you know, take them down or whatever. And then it all comes back later on, but it's turned on him. And that is the point, is that at the start they worship him. And then as it goes on, you realize he's basically ruined them for life because he drilled all this shit into them as teenagers and turned them into these weird little disciples. Yeah. And it's just like it's fucked them up and their relationships and the way they live their lives. Like, the reason they're all so corrupt and unsatisfied and successful but not is because of him. Yeah. And the final reveal of that, there's one character, Martin, who never turns up, and they all talk about him.
Hmm.
And he doesn't come for the reunion, and you find out in the end that they haven't heard from him. One of the team.
Never come, and it's because essentially he wised up when he was young and went, "You're a dickhead." We'll get to that because I think that's a very interesting point as well.
But that's what I mean. It turns out that he injured a player on the other team severely because of the coach, and then never came back.
Yeah, because he was like, I guess, the Judas of the group who saw through the. But he basically realized the coach was giving him bad advice, and he felt bad for cheating, but the coach basically didn't listen to him when he said we should refuse the trophy and all this.
They've all been just in denial, just don't talk about it forever. No, we're all great high school, champions, and then it all comes. But that's the point. That's the point of that scene where they like walk around with, and he is like Jesus and the disciples, and that's why I think the reason for me, at least, that scene doesn't work. Like, for anyone who's not from that kind of background, because, you know, none of us were ever particularly sporty. And, you know, in America, when you are on a, you know, high school kids on a sports team who are good, particularly the era that the story was originally set, like, that was very important.
Yeah.
And he's got, and, you know, another problem with this is that the story is very dated. And if you don't kind of let that go and just go with it, then it comes across as kind of weird, especially to people like us who never played sport. Like, but the reason for me that didn't work is because that bit with the coach and the way they look up to him is the natural beginning of all of their character arcs for the actual story.
Because it is essentially, look, here's some middle-aged guys who used to be the championship-winning jocks. They were a success, and they've gone on to do stuff that's quite good, or at least sounds it on paper. And the film is about revealing to you they're all flawed characters and have issues, and that maybe the reason they have all gone on to be difficult, awkward people is their coach gave them the wrong advice, even though they all think it was the glory days. Their glory days ruined them, in a sense, because it made them into non-underdogs.
You know? And it made them willing to cheat and just pretend they haven't.
Yeah, exactly. And like you're saying, it is the pivotal starting scene that we could have had, maybe, but it's not what we got.
Do you reckon, like, the... Because I was reading up about this film, and when Jason Miller was due to direct it, he kind of insisted that it be set in his hometown.
Yeah.
And that he'd be using it as, like, location. So do you think he specifically wrote a lot of the first half to include, like, the city as a character, per se, to show, like... I do remember a lot of Martin Sheen just kind of walking around the city nostalgic, kind of depressing music.
I think, I think that it would explain it, because if you're going to insist upon it, you've got to then film a lot of it, and then it's kind of not, really, it couldn't have been set anywhere, because it's mainly set in and around a house.
That's it. Like, the play is obviously all in one room, like, or one location, 12 Angry Men style.
Yeah.
So all of the stuff in the first chunk of the film is just unnecessary and superfluous, and it just annoyed the shit out of me.
To the detriment of the film, yeah.
Once it got into the house, that's when I started to enjoy it, but I had a really hard time then tuning back into it.
Yeah, and I mean, so at this point in the story, you're impatient, and I'm thinking, this guy is a creep. He groomed these men, and they're all becoming children again, and it's grossing me out. Abby, what were you thinking of these men and their situation at this point? Like,
by the halfway point, I was bored out of my mind.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So similar to Jimmy, Anthony, you know, how were you interpreting these characters at the early stages before we revealed who they really are?
I think I kind of got the whole thing about the film kind of halfway through, and I kind of figured out what was going to happen, and like, so I don't know.
Because we're all not deluded jocks, really.
Yeah.
Kind of. And I don't know, kind of once we got to like the halfway point when we meet the coach and then he kind of takes them to the school, it's just kind of like, I already have the rest of this film in my head.
It belabors its own point. You're sitting there going, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
What essentially we all got was a bunch of middle-aged men who think they're more or less successful. They are all pleased with where they are, more or less, apart from maybe Martin Sheen, whose character is a bit of an alcoholic. So maybe he's aware he's not a success. But they all love their old days, but think everything's fine. And the film then shows us, they're all dickheads because their coach was a bigot and a cheat and was very good at giving speeches to the boys and making them feel like they're champions, but actually was a complete dickhead. By modern, nice, liberal standards, which most of us have, the guy was a fucking bell end of a coach.
Yeah, full
of terrible advice and an arsewipe about it.
I liked his just like random dropping in of racial slurs as well, just to make you think, no, he's just a prick.
I respect Jews in sport or something, and little Negro boys if they're doing something I understand like sport. But as outside of that, I hate them and think they're different to me.
Yeah, I don't think at any point he refers to someone of another race without using a slur.
There was some stuff I didn't even know. I just had to guess. That's a racial slur.
You have to be very aware of the subtleties between Jews and Gentiles and things.
Yeah, I've been attacking the structure of the film. The performances were good. I thought everybody was on. I liked Martin Sheen. I liked his character. I thought Stacey Keach was really good at being authoritarian but secretly. Desperate for recognition.
Yeah, exactly. Because we do establish that he's telling off the coach of the team in his school, and he's being stern, and the coach is just like, "Okay, thanks for that, dickhead."
Yeah.
Like, then when he's with his friends, he's kind of the lame one wanting approval all the time, and it's because he's all sad because he's been wiping his dad's bum.
Yeah,
and his dad wasn't happy. It wasn't grateful and didn't love him.
And and again, this was one of the parts that engaged me, is when he reveals that, and his little breakdown where he starts crying was so well done. Like, that performance was great.
I was going to say that was my favourite part of the... I think that was my favourite part of the film, because it was the most engaging because of the setup as well. Like, Jason Miller kind of seemed to be like stretching himself and like actually taking his set and using it kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, all the stuff in the house, that's when it got good, but I was so annoyed at that point that I was struggling to pay attention. There are all the great bits where they kept sending Martin Sheen to another room and then immediately telling him to come back.
And also,
it's like, oh, for fuck's sake.
They use the fact that they can go outside either to the backyard or they have Martin Sheen sometimes outside hearing their conversation and then confronting them through the window.
Yeah.
I thought that was much more interesting. It really does pick up when they once they start arguing, which is essentially the first argument. What's it about? Mainly about having an affair, isn't it? Like they guess that there's an affair happening, and they have to talk about it. Then, don't they?
Stacey Keach knows that Paul Sorvino's been having an affair with Bruce Dern's wife, but even then, it turns out that it wasn't. Like, that also comes back to the peaking in high school thing, because Paul Sorvino says that Bruce Dern's character's wife was actually, like, his first love, and he wanted to get that back, and that's why he had that affair.
Yeah, and obviously, that, like, it's going to get heated. Once it's out, that information is outed, you know, it gets to the point where guns are being drawn, which I thought, you know, is a bit... I mean, fair enough, if someone's cheating on you... If your best... One of your friends is cheating with your wife, you know, how do you phrase that? Cheating? He's not cheating on you. Your wife's cheating on you with
one of your best friends.
Whatever. Yeah, there's an affair happening. You might draw a gun. It is America. They have them on their walls, so apparently. you know, so, it, and then, they, you know, they have to, everyone sort of talks the situation down, but there's a massive tension from then on, and that's really leads onto a sequence of different arguments, and some of them resolve, like that one, resolves in that they realise that they can get over it because we find out that the wife was doing it for the political ambition of her husband, and that we find out about the love affair possibly being back from the high school days. So they kind of hash things out and you kind of accept stuff, but then more things get added in, like the alcoholism that Martin Sheen's character is suffering from, and what's the deal with the mustachioed bloke? What's his character's name?
What, Stacey Keach's character?
Yeah, what's his
name? James Daly.
So his problem is that he's insecure and that he's willing to float the idea of wanting to be the mayor as an alternative.
Yeah.
What other problems do we have in the group that come out?
You have Paul Sorvino as well, who's having the affair, has a cocaine problem.
Yeah. And is also... Also, potentially willing to go behind the back of his own friends to maybe, like he might be more aware of the political campaign coming to fail, and is willing to leave it and kind of potentially go to other options.
There are two scenes with his character that I really liked. One of them is the bit where he's shown secretly like taking cocaine, and he talks about what it would be like to crash going at, like 100 miles per hour or whatever. So you get the idea that he's not necessarily suicidal, but that thought has crossed his mind. But also there's a little subplot where he says he's going to switch to the new young guys team, the guy campaigning for mayor.
Yeah.
And they actually push him to call him and do it there and then. And he does, and he tries to buy the guy off, and the guy just tells him to shove it, basically. And it's such a, like, that was fantastic, because it's, I actually wasn't expecting that to happen.
Yeah,
sure. Like, I wasn't expecting him to actually phone, and then I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, it was one of the few times that the film actually, like, caught me by surprise.
Well, it's the sort of thing that people might say in the heat of an argument in jest, but the fact that he picked up the phone and then has a convincing chat with one of the people on the other person's side.
The way he deflates as the guy clearly like isn't going for it, and then like insults him, like racist as fuck, insults him, and then just gets really huffy, and then blames everyone else. That little moment was such a like that was really human, and that was, I think, one of the reasons I was so annoyed that the whole film wasn't just that part in the house. Because all that shit was great. And I would really like to see it or have seen it with this cast, but on stage. Because
It would be hard falling downstairs drunkenly again and again on a stage, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Especially Martin Sheen, as I... you know, as a drunken fall, and also his drunken walk is convincing. Yeah. But his fall, perhaps there's a couple of times where people have to, you know, be a bit physical and.
Oh, that fall down the stairs, wouldn't it? Fantastic.
Yeah. Anthony, were there any bits in the bit that Jamie's starting to say he was enjoying? Are there bits that stand out for you as good pieces of cinema to chew on?
Well, yeah. I mean, Jamie mentioned the first one where Stacey Keach's character is kind of broken down and given his kind of like story. Hmm. And I thought that's one of the bits of the film that kind of piqued my interest, because, like I said, it felt like more of a film. Like the acting was gone up, the blocking of the scene was
definitely
thing. Like the director was thinking a bit more of the composition of the shots, rather than just following them around a house kind of thing. Hmm. But I don't know. Jamie kind of brought up most of the good ones there. Like the telephone conversation was pretty good. I have to say, like, you're right though. The acting in this is like by far the best thing.
Yeah,
and gives it a certain level of credibility that wouldn't be there otherwise.
The actual, like, the dialogue is great. I really like in the house, not in the bit before. I really really like the dialogue, and I would happily see this on stage, because I think that's where this definitely belongs, because a lot of the stuff that they say and a lot of the tension would come from the intensity of the actors doing it in front of you. Mm. And I don't think it works on screen. I don't think it comes across.
Well, I like the direction in the film. I think there's things it does that a play can't, just from the blocking of shots and like just using the house and the rooms well. Like, they're always pulling people off to other rooms. They're sending people upstairs, almost comically, forcefully shoving people upstairs when they ever have a fight. And they use the different spaces in the house, which a play would have, you know, the stage to do it in. But I thought the cinematography this section was good. I liked that they did it, you know.
I think the problem is, and that's reminded me, actually, of something I found out afterwards, is that I think the only way to adapt this for the screen is to have a more experienced director. And it was originally supposed to be William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist and The French Connection, who was going to direct this.
Look at him bringing it around The Exorcist again.
I know. William Friedkin was supposed to direct this, and he ended up dropping out for... Mm. Well, also directed Sorcerer. Let's not forget how good...
So much trivia. Look at him. Yeah, we talked about Sorcerer. It was a good one.
Not forget how good that is. So if he had directed this with Jason Miller's dialogue and possibly without the unnecessary shit in the first half.
And let's face it, if he'd have put it in the back of a rusty truck, now we're talking.
I mean, it very well could have been a fantastic adaptation with William Friedkin directing it and Jason Miller writing and you know, being the like story consultant. But as it is, like, it's almost as if Jason Miller was just kind of... William Friedkin went off to do whatever he had to do, and they went, oh, you do it then. And Jason Miller went,
I could do this. I need an elephant and some cheerleaders. I get your point. You're saying, essentially, we could have a film that's the quality of 12 Angry Men, but it needs to be in slightly different hands.
And again, William Friedkin did go on to direct a remake of 12 Angry Men, so...
Makes sense. Okay, I want to ask Abby, there are a few things I think that are still worth talking about in this bit, but what bits for you, Abby, struck... There must have been some parts you're like, I actually quite like this scene or these interactions in the main chunk of it, Abby?
I don't know, because, like Jamie mentioned in passing, because the first half was so unnecessary... I couldn't really engage with the second half still.
Yeah.
By the time I did, it was almost over.
So you still... Yeah. It had ruined it to the extent that you didn't enjoy it once it got better.
Yeah.
Okay, let me remind you of some things. One, it's always sad to burn fried chicken. Interesting scene as they, you know, realise, oh, all of our crying and arguing got in the way of a good meal, and now we're going to bitterly eat it and argue some more. Also... massive basketball slam to the glass's face.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Was that in any way cathartic to see one of the people you were learning to despise get smacked in the face by a basketball?
Not enough.
Well, they nearly had a... There was a few scraps, you know, did they get up... Well, you know, if they'd have maybe been a powerbomb through a table, would you have gone, this is great?
I think the final massive argument with the coach was good. And, like, it was cathartic. Cathartic is a nice choice of words.
I think before you say why, I think what's weird is at every point the coach is almost coaching them in the argument. Every time they argue, they become like little boys. And he's like, right, I'll take one of you aside. You're going to have a one-on-one chat with me. Let me talk you through your marriage problems. And he's bossing them all around.
I know.
And taking them off one by one. And it's all like, you need to be told, mate, because you are doing my nutting as a watcher. Like,
that's the thing. That's why Martin Sheen's character is great at that point, because he turns it around on the coach and tells the fucking truth.
Yeah.
And then the coach practically has like a breakdown because someone's finally like saying it to him out loud. And he actually chucks Martin Sheen out of the house because he can't deal with it.
Yeah, because essentially, Martin Sheen's character sits there drinking. I mean, that, you know, it's a fine problem to have. but it's not that terrible. To have become an alcoholic isn't the same as I cheat on my best... I have affairs with my best friend's wife, I do cocaine, or it seems like a small problem to be an alcoholic. Go on.
I was just going to say, his problem is that he's more switched on and more honest than the rest of them.
It's like he's sitting there drinking because he knows they're not dealing with the elephant in the room, which is figurative in this sense. And it's that actually we're all lying to ourselves about how awesome it is to be a championship squad of basketball high school kids. And that, you know, we're not really saying what's the truth. And the truth is, we're lying to ourselves. And it's partly the coach's fault. And like you say, he attacks the coach and says, the friend who isn't here had a problem with you because you were said to get so aggressive and we won because we were willing to like foul the opponents, essentially. Yeah. And I think, in a way, to get round to why I think the movie doesn't work, Martin Sheen is thrown out at that point and is going off in a huff and he's willing to go home. But then... like, they play a record, because for some reason they audio recorded the match, and they have a record of the match they played when they were boys, and they're all listening to it after all these arguments about everything. And Martin Sheen's just within earshot, again, that open window's playing a key role, and he hears it, and they all start making up, and they all make friends a bit in the house, and Martin Sheen's the last to come in, and, you know, it's quite an effective scene. But you go, no, this is wrong. Yeah. You're all making friends... See, and you're spoiling it now because you all should have learnt the truth and never met again.
I was about to bring this up as well. I think that was a problem for me as well. And I think that comes down to another problem with the direction. Because if you framed that finale right, with them all coming back and being friends again, you could make that really bleak. Because what I thought they were going to do with it, or what I thought Jason Miller was going to do with it, was... they'd all come back, and it would be clear that they're just going back into denial,
right?
And that they're all coming back together again, and he's gonna be mayor again, but it's obvious that they're all just still lying to themselves, and it's a downer ending. But the film doesn't present it like that.
It presents it like we're all gonna.
Yeah,
like be friends again, and we all love each other really, so we can do this. We can get the mayor re-elected, and we'll all work together as a team again. And if it comes to it, we'll elbow the Jewish other guy who's running for mayor in the ribs, politically speaking.
The music and the presentation of it
learn nothing.
It doesn't show that it's a negative. Thing, yeah, which it is, which you is. Know, it is a, yeah, it yeah. is a downer ending, but it doesn't present it that way. But it doesn't. It's not that it presents it as positive, but it's actually negative. It just presents it almost as 100% positive.
Like,
and
it
I don't
to cheer us up again.
And I don't know if that was necessarily the intent, but and again, it might just be because of Jason Miller's inexperience as a director that he, you know, didn't know how to present it. In that kind of to give it that kind of double meaning,
right?
Which is a shame. You know,
totally. Anthony, you sounded like you might have some thoughts on the matter.
No, I disagree with with what Jamie's saying, and like, well, not only that, I kind of felt like the film could have finished with them just playing the record and then all of them just like walking off. And the same thing with Jamie, if they all came back, but were all, but it was a kind of like sad denial thing.
Yeah.
But it just, I don't know, it just really left a weird taste in your mouth.
Yeah, it presents right at the end. As if, oh, they're all okay, really.
And yeah.
It's not what it's
like they're not.
But it's not even, like, the dialogue, the actual, like, text isn't saying that. It's having them all go back in denial again. It's just the presentation is wrong. It's, like, tonally wrong.
And then they take a picture together, like, on a timer, and we get the final credits play over a picture of them all happily smiling and holding the trophy together as older men. And you kind of go, no, that's not the point. The point isn't that, the glory days. The point is the glory days were a lie. And you've all been horrible adults, and you should all part ways and realise that if anything should change, it's your own attitude to your own lives, and you shouldn't unite together because you're all awful for each other because you support each other's flaws.
That final bit where they take the picture and then it shows the picture and the credits roll, a big problem with that and the tone of it was actually Bill Conti's score, because it was way too positive.
It was almost like, the journey was about, oh no, friends are arguing, I'm going to break up. And then we find out why. And you go, oh, this is like, you know, sometimes people, like, it's like a married couple. Like, they might go through an argument.
Yeah.
And it should, they should give each other the honesty and they finally tell each other what's what and sort it out. But then it should end in divorce and they'll both go off happier. And I felt like, this isn't like their marriage as a friendship shouldn't work. They should all go their separate ways.
Well, see, I like the way the play ends as like,
you say this, but you haven't seen a play.
No. I mean, as like on paper, I like the way the story ends, where they all come back and go, "Ah, no, we can do it." Because you can put that across as what a bunch of fucking idiots.
Yeah.
Like after all this, they're still sticking together. They're doomed to each other.
I get their sentiment though, and I like the fact that Martin Sheen's character comes back and says, like, he kind of doesn't want to admit he's back because he still cares for them all.
Yeah.
And he's like, I just wanted to get the jersey. And that kind of explains, like, I do think our young days were good. And I'm accepting that we're all in this together. But what they're in together is a terrible lie.
Yeah.
And it should be a bit bittersweet, not, yay, we can do
it.
So weird.
It's just, I don't know, the apart from the like a big the chunk in the house, pretty much the whole film is just an exercise in frustration.
Yeah, it's because you just can't sympathise with these because I don't know, maybe it's because I wasn't on a championship winning team at any point. So no, I don't think it's that. I think it's generally the film explained to us that these were people who were lying to themselves, and it's, I don't know.
I just mean generally, like creatively, the film is an exercise in frustration. It's this mashup of like missed opportunities and
five douchebags don't make a right, do they? Like they're all dislikable to some extent. I think I sympathised more with Martin Sheen's character because he was just a kind of struggling writer who was the more in touch with reality than the rest.
Well,
and yet he still deludes himself and his old friends at the end anyway.
See, that's not a problem at all to me. It's just the and as much as it pains me to admit it, because Jason Miller, for the few films he was in, he's one of my like favorite actors, and I don't want to admit that he wasn't a great director, but this is just a weird mashup of just misguided ideas, and it's such a shame because the actual meat of the play, once it gets to it, is really really good.
Interesting. It's about the concept of nostalgia and midlife crisis and friendship. It's kind of an interesting piece about all of these issues that the guys share.
I could see why the play got so much praise when it came out in 72 or 73. And I think it's such a shame that the guy who wrote it ended up not giving it its due on screen.
Right. Abby, I don't know if it's relevant, but as the only lady on the podcast and a woman watching a film that's predominantly about men, in a time where men were men and women were housewives, how did you feel watching the film from the perspective of someone who isn't a man with all these stupid problems?
To be perfectly honest with you, Rich, most of the time I thought, well, fucking twats.
Yeah.
You just thought they were all twats.
And I was just a bit, like, I was sort of on the fence about it until it was the moment when he said, the mayor, Sikowski, said that his wife had slept with Phil for him to get the money, and that seemed fine.
It was almost like, she was doing her duty as a wife, and she isn't a bitch then. And it's like,
well, just them, isn't it? That's the characters. That's the kind of people they are. They are
misogynistic kids. Yeah. I think that's
they
why
made
I didn't
me
like
the people who go on Jeremy Kyle more.
Why? What? How do you mean? If you're on a Jeremy Kyle or Jerry Springer type show, what's so great about the people on there compared to these middle class douchebags?
I feel like the people on there are capable of having actual primitive emotions.
They can't articulate it at the best of times, but they're honest with their lies.
What's interesting, and I think is it speaks about the potential of the script and what this film should do, is that if you look at the one of the main posters for it is one that just features Robert Mitchum in a black and white shot. Hmm. And you can look at that picture and he looks like the villain.
Right.
Because he is, if this is presented right.
Sure. Well, it's the man who groomed young boys to be horrible, misogynistic winners.
He turned them into these awful people.
Because the general message is, you know, win no matter what. The only, like, what's the phrase he uses that's like something about winning and sin and blah? The only...
Oh, there's a few of them. And he just pulls them out of his ass.
Diatribes and bullshit.
Yeah, it is. It's just all empty bollocks. And again, that's as a script, that's great. There's so much potential in that. And the film just doesn't really do anything with it. Or it doesn't do enough with it.
Yeah, maybe. There are things to like. Like, people passively, aggressively throwing a basketball around the garden and tensions building and like this idea of the drama of just arguments and debate can draw you in, and because they have interesting kerfuffles every now and again, it's kind of, there's moments where you enjoy it, I think, but for the most part I just think you're all douchebags, and I've learned these like Anthony, you said you got where the narrative arc was going very early on. And all these idiots should have realised before they'd turned, like, 25, where they were going wrong in life or that they were going down... Like, they should have noticed their flaws before now, you know? Like, and I feel like it was really... The lesson we were supposed to learn from watching it, we already all knew that don't be like these guys, you know?
The film takes so long setting that idea up in the first place that by the time that story actually starts, you're just sitting there, like Anthony said, just going, yeah, I get it.
Yep, got this. You're all going to... We see where this is going. You're all going to slowly learn, and then they kind of do and kind of don't. Frustrating.
Yeah.
Where do we... I feel like we should wrap up with some kind of apt metaphors evaluating the film. Has anyone else got anything else they want to pluck out from something that it could be about anything, music, vision, you know, characters, anything, any last thoughts about something we might have missed, anyone?
I don't think so, but I will mention, because I don't think it was, that I think Martin Sheen was probably the one in the film who was just a bit underplayed or not used enough.
Well, he sat back very quiet a lot of the time, didn't he?
I think that's another problem for this adaptation not making the most of it being on film, and that his character would work fine on stage.
I thought he played it well at times. Like the time where every time he winds someone up, it's like he doesn't care about the argument, but he knows it needles them. And then when he's left alone, I like the tricksy way, like a drunk, he gets up and like steals a drink after he's been told to stop drinking. He's like, he cheekily goes and steals a drink. And like, I quite like the performance.
Maybe that's why I had that feeling, just because when he was there, it was like, maybe just because the character I related to the most, I suppose. But I just wanted more of him. Plus, just some really good drunk acting from him.
Well, he may, considering this is Martin Sheen in the early 80s, he may have actually just been drunk. Like, that may have well have been method acting.
Well, like, either way, I do think they all acted well. I don't think that was a problem. I think they all got what their role was, and it was to portray these different, in different ways, flawed characters. I thought the coach was... I thought the observation about a coach being like that, that just super creeped me out, you know? Like, the fact that he kind of all had them under his wing, it was just like, he doesn't look that much older than you, for one. Like, yeah. And also, who develops a relationship? Like, I don't know many of... Like, I can't say I kept any relationships with teachers beyond school, you know?
The other issue, I think this is a very specific issue as well for, like, us as viewers, is that this is a very, very American story, like, through and through. This is, you know, that's, in part, that's almost what it's about as well. It's
from a time when conservatism was the norm as well, where, so, like, the coach is a bit bent out of shape because he didn't mourn when he got fired for hitting a child that swore at him or something. It's like, that's one of the most awful things I've ever heard.
Yeah, I know.
And you're treating it like, well, I didn't kick up a fuss. Like,
yeah.
I was the true victim of my firing. Right. I could have... instead, I had to spend my life coaching adult men. He seemed to advise them on their everyday life, even as adults now. It's well weird. Weirded me out. But yeah, okay. Any other, Abby, do you have any other moment where you might have, or not moment, but anything else you want to...
I feel like we're retreading a lot here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Once again, very much like the film, we're ending up belaboring the point because the film did it so much that it's hard to get past it.
We're at that uncomfortable, sweaty stage where we all have to decide whether we're going to put our hands in and grab the trophy and say, hey, we're all still friends, or if we would need to go our separate ways or not, then. I don't know. Right, so metaphors. Where are we?
Oh, fuck.
What do we need?
This is going to be a difficult one, I think.
Do you know what? I've kind of got one. This, I would say it's a little bit like American football, in that the actual idea of the game is pretty basic, and in terms of, like, if you wanted to sit with a bunch of people and, you know, get invested, if it was just going back and forth trying to, you know, score, fine. But there's all these weird, like, markings on the pitch and rules and shit, and, like, they keep stopping all the time and organizing it.
Yeah,
and it just becomes this, like, tedious, like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I like, just get over there and score, or stop them or something. Stop making up all this other shit. That is what happens in this film. Okay. It's like, just show me the story.
You want the highlight package at the end of, like, the
exactly. The Super Bowl highlight reel.
Yeah, show me the touchdowns, like, and the amazing tackles and blocks and stuff.
Yeah, not all this, like, just getting into weird, not quite scrums and, like, there being maths all over the pitch and shit.
Yeah, I agree. It's given me one off the back of that. Championships. I can only ever relate things to the sport that is sort of not a sport, which is wrestling. And for me, the way wrestling is packaged is like this film. Like, you know, every week, WWE's wrestling has Raw, and they put on 3 hours of a show. And the first hour is people come out and set up in a really boring way what's going to happen. We all know at the end of the night the main match is going to be about the people who are in the main stories, but we still have to get bored to death with people arguing and explaining stuff and setting up what is going to be a match. We're going to see the match later, but first let's have people boringly set it up.
You're right.
So
and the match like, may it's be like really that. Good.
Yeah, the match may be good, but yeah, like you say, I can't listen to Stephanie McMahon talk about how she hates some bloke because he wants to be the champion and he's a good guy, you know, like, I don't care. Like, I don't need all this at the start to get to the good stuff. So it's like that for me. I'm going to hand it over to one of you guys if one of you's got a metaphor.
I've got a vague metaphor. It doesn't really relate to sport or anything in that way, but I'll see what I can do. It's kind of like you're sitting down to kind of like watch something, or you've like gone to the theater or gone to see a movie, but then before the film starts, like the director comes on or like plays a little short film or something, and it's just like, what was that?
It's just
something unrelated, but supposed to be like really like preachy, and then it kind of just distracts you from the actual film that you're going to watch.
Like it's when like, a film is start like a kids film sometimes have another short animation, and the animation it shows is so disjointed from the one you geared up for, it throws you off.
Yeah.
And you've sat through adverts and trailers as well.
Like that, but more of the effect that like the 80s and 90s in like kid cartoons, they'd always have like a bit of a moral at the end.
Yeah.
It's kind of like putting that at the beginning and forcing them to watch through that.
As if every Quentin Tarantino film had an hour and a half of him talking about what the film's about before it started. So it's like, you're like, shut up, fucking hell.
I'm sure we'll get it from the film. So Abby, are you going to walk off like Martin Sheen, sick of us all, or have you got something to say?
This film is a trophy on someone else's shelf that looks pretty good. You go up to it and then you find out it's one for participation.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, it's got the same guy on it, like the same heroic looking sports winner, but it says participant. Yeah, could you elaborate on how that relates to the film? Or
it's just, he came, he tried hard, didn't work.
Yeah, it just didn't land, did it, you know. But thanks for trying. You did make a film. You've always got that. You can't take it away. You always made a film, and it was apparently off the back of quite a good play. I don't know what the remake was like, if they sorted. Maybe they sorted all these problems out in the 90s or whenever.
No, apparently the remakes. Well,
they made it all about the elephant. And it was so much more harrowing.
The remake has a reputation of being boring, whereas this one doesn't.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So that would be quite the experience.
It wasn't utterly boring. Like, every bad thing has entertaining moments, like the sports metaphors we've mentioned. But yeah, it's not enough.
Like I said, I would much rather watch this on stage.
Or The Exorcist, which is what you truly love most.
Or, no, I wish this had been directed by William Friedkin, like it was supposed to be.
Well, we'll never know, because that's not going to happen. So, you know, that wraps up our long, heated debate about this film. And now we all must wander off into the night. or just end the podcast. You get what I'm saying, listener. It's time to say goodbye. So, ta-ta.
Bye.
Goodbye.